Iran summons the German ambassador over Berlin's interventionist comments on Iran's response to the riots. The U.S. is lobbying to stop the United Nations from blacklisting companies doing business in Israeli settlements. The European Union will be adding $2 billion to a fund that's feeding arms into Ukraine. Welcome. The top story this hour, Iranian Foreign Ministry summoning the German ambassador to Tehran. The ministry has strongly protested what it calls the continued meddlesome comments by German authorities on developments inside Iran. The ministry says that Germany's interference in Iran's internal affairs is unacceptable. It denounced the European country for supporting riots and instability in the Islamic Republic. The foreign ministry also criticized what it called double standard by German officials towards subversive attempts in Iran and Germany. That was in reference to the riots in Iran as well as a recent coup attempt in Germany. The foreign ministry said that Berlin is adopting a hypocritical approach toward Iran's response to terrorism and violence. And that's while Germany considered its own security a red line in the face of the recent events there. On Friday, Germany summoned the Iran ambassador over the execution of a rioter in Iran. Tehran pledging to respond to Western sanctions and intervention in its affairs over the recent riots in the country. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the pledge in a phone conversation with EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Western countries have been condemning Iran's response to the unrest. They've imposed sanctions on the country for alleged crackdown on protesters. Amir Abdullahian also touched upon the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. The foreign minister said that the U.S., France, Germany, the U.K. are wrong to assume that they can pressure Iran into making concessions in the negotiations. He, however, stressed that the discussions are on track to take the final step toward a good, strong, and durable agreement. Now, author and journalist Robert Fantina tells us more about Western double standard on human rights.
Germany is criticizing Iran's policies, and yet it says nothing about Israel's brutal, ongoing, for decades, policies against the Palestinians. The killings of the Palestinians, the destructions of their homes, the destruction of their economy. Germany has full diplomatic relations with Israel and never says a word about that. And now when there's some internal unrest in Iran, it is immediately condemning the Iranian government. The same with Canada. Canada needs to get its act cleaned up regarding its treatment of indigenous people within our borders. I'm in Canada. Before it starts criticizing anybody else for any alleged or genuine human rights violations, Canada is committing them on a regular basis against the indigenous people in Canada, and so is in no position to denounce any other countries' behaviors until it does something about its own. This hypocrisy we see in certainly the United States, where people of color are imprisoned at a much higher rate, astronomically higher rate than whites, where racism is institutionalized, and yet the United States will criticize what's happening in Iran now, what the Iranian government is doing. It's all to bring about regime change so that a government that's compliant to U.S. demands, that will follow U.S. dictates, will be installed in Iran.
The European Union is going to add more than $2 billion to a fund that's used to help arm Ukraine, but that could face delays amid differences with Hungary. EU diplomats said a preliminary agreement has been struck among the 27 member bloc to bolster the European peace facility. The fund's already committed over 3 billion euros to cover the cost of weaponry for Kiev. The deal was set to be signed on Monday, but a stand-up with Hungary over its own frozen EU funds could see Budapest delay approval. The EU has frozen Hungarian funds over the country's opposition to the bloc's sanctions on Russia and its refusal to support the war in Ukraine. Hungary argues that the EU is playing a dangerous game by providing Ukraine with destructive weapons, training Ukrainian soldiers, and imposing sanctions on Russian energy. There are now more food banks in the UK than there are McDonald's. Soaring inflation and energy price hikes are forcing more people to rely on food aid to avoid starvation. And with the cold season already in full swing, charities are warning things are going to take a turn for the worse for millions of Britons. Syed Purza reports.
Doors at food banks across the UK are seeing more people come through now than ever before as food and energy costs rise. Beans, noodles, and fruit. Food packaged up for people in crisis, not in the developing world, but in northwest London.
This is one of the thousands of centres across the UK. All this food is sorted, packaged, and distributed by the volunteers here to people who desperately need them. Without them, they go hungry.
In the queue outside, Sarah, who asked her face not to be shown, told us she'd go days without food so her three children could eat.
I go days without eating as long as they get fed. I can go days without it. I can do it, but it's them I'm concerned. It's worrying for me for them to go without food. But I can go without food for a couple of days or so, just eat, drink milk, hot chocolate, yogurts and stuff, so they can have a full meal. Like, everything I have, it's all for them. So, you know, it is difficult.
This independent charity provides aid to 800 food bank users. And with the UK's economic downturn making the poor even poorer, they're warning more people will be knocking on their doors.
According to the government's new budget, benefits will be increasing in line with inflation, but that's not until April. So that means our guests will continue to struggle throughout the winter for the next few months, throughout the rain and snow and cold weather.
These bags only offer days of help, but that too could be under threat. Food banks are now at breaking point due to a tsunami of need driven by the cost of living crisis.
Regular donors are unable to donate what they used to. Funders have less money to give to support because of all of that was spent during the pandemic. So while our demand is still the same, the support that we need to provide it is running out.
Charities estimate more than 2 million people in Britain now depend on food aid. For now, help is around, with those in need hoping the country's economic outlook improves. The question is how long that will take. Saeed Puriza, London.
Chinese President Xi Jinping says his country would work to buy oil and gas in its national currency, yuan. That's a move that backs Beijing's goal to establish its currency internationally. She says that Beijing will also make full use of the Shanghai Petroleum and National Gas Exchange as a platform for oil and gas trade with yuan. He made a comment in Saudi Arabia in an official visit. China is the third largest trading entity in the world behind the U.S. and the EU. Beijing has been encouraging partners to use its currency in bilateral trade in a de-dollarization push. A political commentator Digby James Wren says that China's attempt to de-dollarize its oil and gas purchases is another sign of shifting from the greenback to currencies other than the U.S. dollar.
This is a very consequential shift in global markets. It makes sense, and as you mentioned in your introduction, the Shanghai Commodities Exchange is a key part of that, and that's taken quite a few years to set up. You cannot have this kind of exchange in yuan directly for energy if you don't have commodity markets established. So that was the first or one of the steps that needed to be taken. But it also shows that for the Saudis and for the BRICS nations, for example, and also for the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, that there's a definite shift in the global south. The Americans have really undermined their own reputation because they've been weaponizing the use of the dollar. And so, of course, that accelerated the need or the requirement of other countries to not to stop using the dollar, but to start using the yuan and the euro much more. So a kind of a tripartite, sort of a three currencies, which I like to call the yes arrangement. So yuan, euro, and dollar. And so this is a stabilization of the global financial and commodities markets.
The U.S. says it's pressing the United Nations not to update a blacklist of companies doing business in Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. State Department saying that the U.S. opposes any work to update the list. It claims that a database reinforces bias against Israel and poses a genuine threat to companies active in those elements. The list was first published in 2020 by the UN Human Rights Office. It came in response to a 2016 resolution by the UN Human Rights Council that called for identification of businesses engaged in activities related to those elements. The listing has helped human rights groups pressure those companies to boycott Israel over its crimes against Palestinians. In Peru, supporters of former President Pedro Castillo clashed with police for a second day. They demand the release of Castillo, who was impeached and arrested over an attempted coup d'etat. The police used tear gas and batons to disperse the rallyers who were chanting slogans against new President Dina Boluarte in the capital, Lima. Similar protests were held elsewhere, including in the flashpoint city of Arequipa. Demonstrators blocked roads, burned barricades, and demanded early elections. Protesters say that they did not recognize Boluarte, who took over as interim president after Castillo's removal. Lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to remove Castillo following his failed attempt to rule by decree and dissolve Congress to avoid a third impeachment vote. The interim president has called for calm. The Al-Quds International Institute has held a conference in the besieged Gaza Strip to shed light on Israeli violations in Al-Quds and also ways to confront the Judaization of the Holy City. Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status. Ashraf Shannon reports.
A conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is dubbed Judaization of Al-Quds and ways to confront it. Experts, academics, and senior Palestinians have attended the conference. They have discussed ways to tackle the growing Israeli violence against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This, as Israeli officials have been trying to Judaize the holy Muslim city of Al-Quds in the past by demolishing Palestinian homes and building illegal Jewish settlements.
We are holding this conference to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to reaffirm the Islamic identity of Al-Quds. Holding this event this year is of great significance amid the escalation of Zionist aggressions against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state. Speaking to Press TV, the Hamas movement asserted the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Quds and refuted all Israeli claims to the holy city.
Quds was never a state or a capital of a state for the Jews. The history indicated that it was part of Palestine, and Palestine was and still is a part of the Arabic countries, which is a part of the Islamic world.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Those who attended the conference slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime.
I think that as Al-Quds is not just only for Palestinians, it's for Arabs and for Islamic nations. So why the Arabs now normalize the relation with Israel, and they do all their efforts against Palestinians?
In its final communique, the conference stressed the importance of protecting Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and has been turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now, Lebanon security forces say that there has been a significant increase in the number of the Lebanese recruited by the Israeli spy agency Mossad. They cite the Arab country's deepening economic crisis as the main reason for that rise. Mariam Saleh has more in this next report.
Lebanon has arrested 185 people suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency since October 2019, when the Arab country's ongoing economic crisis became apparent.
This is Israel's intelligence agency's invasion of the Lebanese virtual sovereignty. The Israelis took advantage of the economic crisis and the fact that the Lebanese are looking for job opportunities with U.S. dollars coming from abroad. And so they created fake companies through which they acquired thousands of resumes from Lebanese people. They were able to contact any one of those job hunters in the guise of foreign companies, while in reality they were Israeli recruiters.
Lebanese security sources have told AFP that the number has increased dramatically, from from only 4 or 5 arrests per year.
One of the most notable examples of this was the busting of over 35 Lebanese and Palestinians that were gathering intelligence on Hezbollah and of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon for Israel. Israel, again, used a lot of fake companies and front groups to trap those kind of in a desperate economic situation into accepting these fake front opportunities.
Out of the 185 people arrested since 2019, 165 have been prosecuted and 25 convicted and sentenced.
The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in several ways, but it seems it's not the only reason for treason. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their communications with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to the resistance.
When we read the interrogation reports of those who were arrested, we understand that it was more than only giving intelligence. One of the suspects admits that he was asked to write articles aimed at sowing sedition amongst the Lebanese and inciting people against Hezbollah and resistance. They asked him, for example, to write articles which would give an impression that Hezbollah is linked to the Beirut port explosion in order to provoke hatred against the resistance movement.
Political analysts believe recruiting spies by the Israeli regime will continue since a military option is not on the table.
These kinds of more subtle forms of gaining influence in Lebanon, and especially putting people into a very desperate economic state and taking advantage of that, seems to both basically cut the losses on the military front that Israel and the U.S. Even know that it has unmatched against the resistance forces in the region.
Although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with Israel, there has been no direct confrontation between the two sides since 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities have never stopped. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
future.
At the height of the Cold War, the CIA launches a highly classified, top secret research program into the covert use of biological and chemical agents. In simulated attacks on enemy populations, entire cities throughout America are contaminated with bacteria, exposing millions of Americans to germ warfare. But the real focus of the research is on mastering the art of mind control. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. LSD had become one of the CIA's key interests for its brain warfare program. As the agency theorized, it could be useful in interrogations. Mind control experiments generally centered around behavior modification via electroshock therapy, hypnosis, polygraphs, radiation, and a variety of drugs, toxins, and chemicals. Now, these experiments relied on a range of test subjects, some who freely volunteered, some who volunteered under coercion, and some who had absolutely no idea that they're involved in a sweeping defense research program. And what was the extent of these brainwashing experiments? How did the CIA use unconsenting people as guinea pigs in thousands of different experiments? Join us on Aperture for your answers on CIA covert experiments.
August 16, 1951. Madness spreads through the village of Pont-Saint-Esprit in the Gard region in France. Dozens of villagers have been victim of these bouts of madness. The press describes men terrorized by snakes swirling in their stomachs. A doctor recounts the evening of the 25th of August, where dozens of locals were seized by convulsions, like in a night of the apocalypse. Reports from the victims are terrifying. Saint-Esprit, they call it the cursed bread drama, because all of those who fell ill ate the bread from the Brion bakery. It's the first time in France that a whole village has gone mad. It made headlines in the press, who wondered what could have caused this collective hallucination. In Pont Saint-Esprit, the locals panic, and nobody will touch the bread. The hearses quickly arrive in the village. In total, 7 deaths, 300 people poisoned, and around 50 admitted to psychiatric wards. The first dead were buried. The investigators initially thought it was a return of St. Anthony's fire, a disease that killed many thousands in the Middle Ages, caused by a parasitic ergo fungus that attacks cereals. The baker was accused of poisoning, then the miller. Arrested and incarcerated, they were released after several months. They say that their confessions were made under duress, and above all, the evidence proved their innocence. It was then thought to be water poisoning, mercury, fertilizers, or a nearby gas factory. But the evidence disapproved these theories one by one. Since then, in Pont Saint-Esprit, more far-fetched theories have surfaced. Nothing is clear, and for decades the incident goes unexplained. But against all expectations, 60 years later, a new theory is proposed. Not from France, but from the United States. An American researcher in the Secret Services, Hank Albarelli, is investigating the suspicious death of a biochemist from the CIA, Frank Olson. A specialist in chemical weapons, he carried out experiments on hard drugs like LSD. He was also in France a few months before the Pont Saint-Esprit incident. Afterwards, he kept sinking into depression, telling his wife that he'd made a terrible mistake. Hank Albarelli then made the link with the Pont-Saint-Esprit incident. Could it have been the CIA and the American Army spraying LSD onto the bread?
I have no doubt at all that Pont-Saint-Esprit was a U.S. Army covert experiment. Initially, I had doubts, and I think initially my doubts were motivated by wishful thinking on my part, where I didn't want it to be an experiment. It was hard to fathom the government doing that. Although at the same time, there were a number of research tracks that were being conducted for the book at the same time. So my being naive about what the government and the U.S. Army was capable of doing was the threshold for that was dwindling.
Is it possible that the Americans drugged an entire village in an ally country, causing, no doubt accidentally, the death of 7 people? Improbable. However, to understand what happened in Pont-Saint-Esprit, we need to look back at the end of the Second World War, when the level of atrocities committed by the Nazis was discovered in the camps, notably horrific experiments carried out on thousands of prisoners by chemists or doctors. Men lacerated, poisoned, burnt alive, exposed to radiation. The Allies hunted the war criminals from Hitler's regime. In 1946, in Nuremberg, the doctors are put on trial. 22 men and one woman who experimented on human beings, who they transformed into lab rats, stand accused. The trial sets a precedent. 7 of the accused are sentenced to death, 11 given prison sentences, and 5 are acquitted. As a result, the Americans draft the Nuremberg Code, a model which gives strict rules for experimenting on humans, notably the voluntary consent of the human subject is absolutely essential. The experiment must be designed to avoid all unnecessary suffering, physical and mental harm. With the Nuremberg trial barely over, the winners remain cynical. The American Secret Service begins Operation Paperclip. Nearly 1,500 German scientists, including war criminals, are expatriated to America. They are offered a new life in exchange for their knowledge and cooperation.
It was a very serious game of propaganda that we were playing. It was almost a show trial. We're putting the Nazis on trial, but in fact, behind the curtain, we're doing some very nasty things ourselves to basically incarcerated people, poor people, individuals who at the time were called feeble-minded and locked up in institutions. And if you were in one of those institutions, whether you were indigent or an unwed mother or had some sort of mental incapacity, there's a good chance that you may have been incorporated in some sort of medical study, possibly for the government or not, where you would have been used and abused.
Assisted by the German scientists, the Americans begin pursuing their goal of the ultimate weapon, and everything is allowed in the name of the Cold War. On the one side was the Army, whose priority is to win the nuclear arms race. the time, to test the effects of radiation on a large scale, they used their own soldiers, who were docile and disciplined. Between 1946 and 1962, between 250,000 and 500,000 men were exposed to radiation on Bikini Atoll or in the Nevada desert. They were exposed with no protection, unaware of the risks involved. And afterwards, the radiated particles were cleaned up with brooms.
How about radiation? Do you think there's much danger from radiation?
Well, radiation is the least of the worries that the men are thinking about.
I think most people thought that radiation was the greatest danger, didn't they? Where did they learn different?
Well, prior to our instructions here, we received a very thorough briefing before we even came this close to contact with it.
On the other side was the CIA, who was above all interested in psychological manipulation. Their goal was to create an infallible truth serum, wipe memories, turn humans into robots, and program them to kill. Conveniently, in 1948, a researcher in the Sandoz laboratories, Albert Hoffman, discovers a molecule that ignites the Secret Service, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. It's derived from the same rye fungus long held responsible for the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. It was believed that the hallucinogenic properties of this drug were key to psychological manipulation. Fearing that the Russians would get their hands on Sandoz's samples, the Americans bought all of their stock. The discovery of LSD was a godsend for the Army, who on the brink of nuclear weapons were looking for a weapon that could defeat an enemy without firing any weapons. The man who was head of this program longest was James Ketchum, shown here in uniform. He was a psychiatrist who was working for the military. As a patriot, he was prepared to push the boundaries in his research. He tested around 30 drugs, but especially LSD and the dangerous benzylate. He treated 7,000 soldiers, hundreds of whom later sued the Army because of the side effects that they still experience and attribute to these drugs. However, when questioned, James Ketchum sees things differently.
I think they were very patriotic. They've not been given credit. They've been called innocent guinea pigs, which they certainly were not. They knew what they were doing, and we told them as much as we could about it. We had to limit the names of the drugs because some of them were artificially made, and if we were to give out the name, of course, that would also reveal the structure, and that we were afraid the Russians would get that. They were apparently following our work. We thought they were ahead of us, but actually they weren't, and so they were watching what we did to see what they could learn and use, and they developed a similar drug later themselves.
In parallel with the Army, the CIA was also developing its own programs, codenamed Bluebird, Artichoke, and later MKUltra. But to carry out these programs on a large scale, they needed funds. In 1950, the Korean War gave them the ideal pretext. Some American soldiers were captured. During their detention, pilots admitted having dropped chemical weapons onto Korea, which was forbidden. The Americans claimed this was due to psychological manipulation, and the CIA took advantage of this godsend to obtain budgets that allowed them to work on brainwashing.
During the Korean War, the American pilots who were captured started making apparently false confessions of germ warfare. The first question is, was it really false confessions? But then when they were brought back to the United States, the military and the military psychiatrists studied them and decided that there's mind control operations being run against Americans. So for defensive purposes, we had to study this, figure it out, therefore we created MKUltra. Before MKUltra was Bluebird and Artichoke. So the The whole rationale is it's defensive. It's because of what the communists are doing. Problem is, the Korean War started in June 1950, and Bluebird was signed into operation by the head of the CIA in April 1950.
In the Edgewood camp where James Ketchum worked, soldiers are called upon more and more. They think they're testing gas masks. In reality, the canisters are filled with a toxic chemical.
They were testing a whole assortment of different hallucinogens like LSD and marijuana and things like that. And they explored other drugs, very high levels of atropine, scopolamine, benzolates, very powerful. And a lot of these soldiers ended up incapacitated. It took them a long time to recover. And while they're in recovery, the doctors cannot do any more experiments because it's basically a very small base and testing operation. In other words, they needed a new site.
It's in this context of the Cold War and secret agents that on the 16th of August, 1951, the tragedy at Pont-Saint-Esprit unfolded. France was suffering economically, and the Americans distrusted this ally they couldn't control. The village was under the control of socialists at the time. In the eyes of America, they were Reds, the epitome of the Soviet danger. But the mayor, Roger Castillon, doesn't believe in a foreign conspiracy. Yet American experts like Colin Ross are much more down to earth.
Obviously, that compound didn't just come in the rain or just wasn't sitting around naturally. It was obviously organized, controlled, distributed. So whether it was actually LSD or some other compound doesn't make that much difference. Pont-Saint-Esprit is actually not just this happened once in the world in a village in France. It's consistent with all the other experiments on the public that have done in the United States and done for a documented fact.
To achieve their goals, would the Americans be prepared to use a whole village as a laboratory? After all, these are civilians, not trained soldiers. However, in September 1950, nearly 1 year before Pont-Saint-Esprit, this is exactly what they did. And in their own country. Off the coast of San Francisco, the American Marines were carrying out military maneuvers. A ship approached the coast and bombarded the city with a bacteria causing nucosomia, Serratia marcescens. The military were testing the effects of spraying this through the air. This classified secret defense map shows the scale of the targeted area. At least 11 people were hospitalized, one of whom died of pneumonia. The villagers wonder why a supposedly festive drug that is loved by hippies would have had such terrifying effects at Pont-Saint-Esprit. James Ketchum, the military psychiatrist who specialized in LSD, a little reluctantly, admits that the drug is scary for those who take it unknowingly.
Some individuals could have a bad trip if someone gave them LSD and didn't tell them about it. That's very anxiety-producing. Or if they were inexperienced and not particularly well balanced themselves, took a fairly large dose of LSD, they could have a bad trip. How would you feel if you had a cup of coffee and started to see things going like this or like this, or brilliant colors appear on the ceiling, or suddenly you felt you're out of your body and looking down on yourself. These are all things that can happen with LSD.
But can these effects have a delayed onset? In Pont-Saint-Esprit, the older generation remember the night of the apocalypse, where dozens of men went mad and were sectioned in a psychiatric unit because of terrifying visions. This night took place more than 2 weeks after the cursed bread was consumed. But again, James Ketchum admits that it's possible.
Some individuals had flashbacks later in which they would go into a situation where they had been when they were taking LSD and have a flood of the same emotions and some of them anxiety producing.
In 1951, French investigators also consider LSD and call upon Albert Hoffman, inventor of the drug. On the spot, he tells the investigators that he has no doubt that the hallucinations were due to LSD. But after returning to Switzerland, he backtracks, claiming he was mistaken. The French want explanations, but public health documents from 1951 show that the expert became suddenly unreachable. We are sorry that the eminent professor has not been able to get back in touch with us.
I would think if the Sandoz scientists are saying it doesn't seem to be LSD, they're just trying to cover up the fact that it's 100% for sure that LSD must have come from Sandoz, because they were the only suppliers. That's nothing more than a cover-up.
After months of inquiry, the French investigators were so disoriented by the number of fruitless leads that the incident at Pont Saint-Esprit falls victim to its own mystery. During this time, the experiments continued in the United States, and they reached a level never seen before in any country, including the Soviet bloc. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me in a new episode of For a Better Life. You are listening to IRB English Radio. This is Asma. I'm a student of English literature and at your service as the one who's just sharing her perspectives with you. Well, just as I said, I don't tend to sound like a lecturer, for I am not, and it's just a friendly, cozy corner in which I whisper to you some words that I hope they might work like a sparkle, a click in your thought. We all know sometimes life goes through a busy circle of tiresome routine, that we even forget ourselves. So it's pretty easy to forget some very important, crucial facts that are the backbones of our life. So it'll be good if just for some moments we take a short rest and think about where we are headed to. Psychology proves that we get too much of our psyche developed during our childhood. Major parts of our characteristic, or the so-called idiosyncrasy, is going to get shaped through childhood, the time when we know only two creatures in our life, and it takes time for us to recognize that we are separate, independent beings. That's why parents have a crucial impact on their children's mental and, of course, spiritual growth. So many of the mental complexes that numerous numbers of adults might suffer from have got their roots in their childhood and their relationship with their parents. So there's no doubt the parents have huge impact on the future of their children, and that's why it's a great responsibility to be parenting a child. In our religious narrations, we also have too much of advices for parents and the way they must treat their children. So all that matters is the fact that bringing up a child is not an easy task at all, regarding the psychological and mental issues of the children, of course. Now, what are the outcome of an ill parenting? We all know it, and in short, we could say that the human beings who lack too much of many things, weak and feeble characters, small creatures with limited understanding. And just to be fair, I must also add this very point that we shouldn't blame only the parents for that, because now I'm going actually to say more about it. It's not just the parent who are responsible. I said all these things just to point at parents for some parts of the story and then leave the rest for ourselves. Because we ourselves are pretty much responsible for every single thing that happens in our lives. The decisions we make, the knowledge we gather, the much of growing we try to go through as we get older, all of these things are in our hand and have too much of impact in our future. So it's not just our parents, and we shouldn't just, I'm not giving you a reason to accuse your parents for every single thing that happened in your life, of course not. I'm just saying this for those parents who are not taking too much of care about the way they treat their children. So the reason for that is that even if you are a marble, a stone, or whatever, you could get a beautiful shape if you work on yourself, if you engrave some beautiful things upon it. You also are responsible for who you are and for whatever that happens in your life. And now I don't want to mention environment and society, because this is not the story I'm going to talk about, and it's not our main concern right now. So my character is shaped mostly in my childhood, and my complexes have got their roots somewhere in my childhood. One of these disorders is selfishness and not wishing for others the same things that I wish for myself. But before that, let's go for a short break and get to the rest. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is For a Better Life. We're talking about our essence. We're talking about what happens to us when we do not take care of ourselves, when parents do not focus on the bringing up of their children, and when those children, when they grow up, they do not go for studying more, for improving themselves, for developing their psyche, for improving themselves, actually. So we talked about selfishness and about the fact that this is a kind of sickness not to wish the same thing for others that you wish for yourselves. And, you know, it's nothing that comes from other planets. We see it around us, and sometimes we ourselves are inflicted by these sickness. And sometimes we ourselves are inflicted with these sort of maladies. What I want to say is that it is true that these things have a root in our childhood, and it's true that it's not very easy to snap them out of our psyche. But there is a thing, and it is about our will. It is about the power of human beings, about their power of thinking, and about the power of deciding to do something pretty much determined. As a human being, when we know there is something wrong with us, with our true essence, with our characteristics, we can find a way to solve it. First of all, we can consult a psychologist or a spiritual advisor. But that's not all. Sometimes it needs the help of you yourself. We see a lot of people at the age of 40 or even older, they're still the same people that they were when they were in their 20s. So this shows the very thing that they have never thought about themselves, or maybe they have never wished to change, or maybe they have never tried to go further to develop themselves, to flourish, actually. I have seen some examples with my eyes that they were not born in great families. They didn't get a good treating from every person that lived around them. But as they grew older, they studied, they worked on themselves, they went through too much of experiences. And after all, they managed to get through the dilemmas and the complexes they were suffering from. So it's not, let's say, a miracle. It happens, and if you decide, if you try to do it, it would actually happen. Whether it be selfishness, whether it be this sense of envy that some people have toward other people, whether it be some other bad things that might cause some different inflictions on other people's lives. So whatever it would be, you can change it, and you already know that it's going to have a bad effect if you're not going to solve it. It's going to have a bad effect on other people that are living around you, the people that are your friend, your family. You can even harm your family with that.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
For your mental health and for your peace, you have to always think about yourself, ponder about your good features, bad features, and try to solve them. Because the first person who is going to help yourself get improved and get out of the problems that your character is suffering from is you yourself. If you work on it, for sure it will happen. And it's not something that is not going to be done, you know? It's just your will. You decide and then you go for it. And then God would help you for it. You know, we all have it in our narration as well, that when a person who's having a wrong characteristic asks Allah to help him improve herself or himself, if you take 40 days of watching over yourself, watching every single action you do, then after that 40 days, Allah himself is going to guarantee your future and your character. That means you're not going to do the wrong things you were doing before. So now this is all the time that we had for today's episode. Just to wrap it all up, I was talking about our characteristics and how important it is to every now and then watch it over and see what's going on with ourselves. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he knows. Alone.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.